John Hockenberry here. Thank you for downloading this podcast from WNYC and Public Radio International. You're a very discriminating person, I can tell that. Remember, we're as keen to hear from you as we are from John in Dallas or Joan in Eugene. You can follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway and find out more at thetakeaway.org. Here then, for your listening pleasure, is The Takeaway Podcast. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. On day two of an unfolding event that has placed Paris under siege, gunmen at large, a manhunt underway for the attackers of the Charlie Hebdo magazine offices, where a dozen were killed this week, the city is humbled by moments of silence, reflection, vigils for the dead, solidarity with the living. They're chanting freedom of expression at one of the many vigils in Paris and around France where it is an official day of mourning for, I'll remind you again, the 12 individuals killed by gunmen on Wednesday at the offices of that satirical newspaper, Charlie Hebdo. We'll also hear this hour for reaction from cartoonists who use their talents to make sharp political points and, as we learned this week, take significant risks sometimes. What is the link to the Middle East in these deadly attacks? There are reports that the two men at large may have trained in Syria. In September, France's interior minister warned that nearly 500 French citizens are fighting with ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Counterterrorism officials have warned that these jihadis would return to their home countries eventually with professional military training and a renewed ideological zeal to strike Western targets. Is this indeed what has happened in this attack? Many questions. Samuel Laurent joins us. He's a French author and Middle East expert who focuses on extremism. Samuel Laurent, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello. Thank you very much, John.
Do you think there is a strong link between these individuals and training in Syria, or at least sympathies with what's going on in Syria and Iraq?
Well, there's more than a link, actually. It has been established that one of them had links with previous organizations fighting in Iraq. In 2008, one of them has been arrested. One of them that is still at large has been arrested for channeling French jihadi into Iraq. So therefore, yes, definitely there is a link. And there was a connection. We knew these people for many years. And this guy has even been incarcerated, has been in prison in France for 18 months prior to his release. So they were very well known from French security service. And the question that should be asked today is, how come such signaled people and people that should be monitored by the French security services could have launched such a striking and such a sophisticated attack in the middle of Paris using war weapons?
Is it believed that the authorities are monitoring individuals on a more or less constant basis and that these folks might have slipped through the cracks?
Yeah, definitely. Well, there are two things. You know, ISIS is now popping up like mushrooms. We have new jihadis coming every day, hardly, in France. And those people are very difficult to monitor, very difficult to profile. Some of them are 14-year-old girl willing to travel to Syria. Some others are 55-year-old men that has been identified in the ISIS front. So there is a multiplicity of profile. However, the easier one to target would have been those ones which were spotted for years as being members of Qaeda cells operating from France to Iraq. So therefore, yes, it is very difficult to identify all the potential threats, but this one was among the clearest.
What do you make of the target, Charlie Hebdo? I would think that this is not a target that is likely to terrorize all of Paris, but in fact would be perceived more as a target that Muslims in France would not be likely to defend in any way.
Actually, you know, there are two aims at those terrorist acts. Obviously, is to strike French. That's the first point. But also to gain the heart of radical Muslims. And now those people were claiming, according to one witness, which was in Charlie Hebdo at the time of the killing, were claiming to be from Al-Qaeda. And therefore, we could only imagine for now that there is kind of a competition to basically gain the upper hand in global jihad between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. So therefore, yes, Charlie Hebdo has published a few years ago some drawings which were quite disrespectful, according to zealous Islamists, of the Prophet Muhammad. So therefore, this was a very symbolic target for Muslim. And this is something that is likely to be very popular among extremist Muslims. We can see from now on that on social media networks, we had a lot of greetings from Syria, from French fighters, who are basically congratulating those people for what they did.
And talk about the geography of Paris for a moment. I mean, unlike some other cities, the suburbs of Paris, some of the inner ringed suburbs of Paris are entirely Muslim communities that don't mix terribly much with the rest of Paris. I would think that the configuration of Paris makes it really easy for people like this to disappear back into the community.
Definitely. We had a policy for decades now, which was basically to, I would say, group some communities inside suburbs. Not only in Paris, all large cities in France have this problem. And yes, as you said, there are rings basically among major cities in which in some areas police do not even enter. And in those areas, gangs are not having the upper hand, and they control drug trafficking. They control all criminal activities, but definitely the bosses of those places are the Salafi jihadi, are the radical preachers that have been formed in, especially in Britain, which is really a hotbed of radical Salafia nowadays. And those people are basically, yes, controlling some whole districts around our cities.
Samuel Laurent, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Samuel Laurent is a French author and Middle East expert who just returned from Syria. He spoke with us from Paris. France, the biggest nation you heard there, threatened by jihadists, but certainly not the only one in Europe. Peter Veit joins us now, Dutch diplomat and former special representative for the European Union, who has watched jihadist tensions targeted at journalists and others transform the debate over religious and ethnic tolerance and pluralism across Europe. He joins us from his home in Sweden, a country that has opened its arms to Syrian refugees and is expected to welcome 95,000 new immigrants in 2015 alone. Peter Veit, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Remind us of how much this kind of tragedy that we're seeing unfolding in Paris has also been visited on other cities in Europe.
Well, a couple of thoughts here. First of all, of course, shock and horror at the attack and also increasing anger at what happened. It's an attack on the freedom of expression. Can we still poke fun at each other? Can we still poke fun at our political leaders? These are the questions one can ask oneself. Secondly, deep concern about the calm, professional way in which the attack has been carried out, yet very ruthless. So all these sophisticated type of weapons used give me deep concern about what's more being hidden in the communities. And third, if I may, a more broader political question. How will Islamic leaders react to this incident, to this attack? I'm thinking of the leaders of the Islamic communities in Europe, but also the leaders of Islamic states around the world. Will they condemn this? Or will they stay rather mute because of the consideration that blasphemy may perhaps be a mitigating circumstance, not justifying, but nevertheless to be taken into account when violence by extremists occurs? So that's a question we will have to see.
Well, Peter Veit, let me just focus that. I mean, it seems to me that the perpetrators of this attack specifically want to make it very difficult for moderate Muslim leaders to say anything other than we're very, very sorry, but Charlie Hebdo had it coming, which is a victory for them.
Yes, exactly. But this is now coming to the point for our long term thinking. If that is going to be the reaction from Muslim leaders, that would open the door and set a precedent in my perception. I think what we need to insist upon is that there is an absolute condemnation by Islamic leaders all over the world of what happened. There can be no justification for this type of violence. And blasphemy, it can be offensive, but in our societies, cartoonism, humor, satire are basic values and principles in our culture, in our society.
But people were executed for blasphemy in Europe in past centuries. It's a closer echo, perhaps, than we might think what Al-Qaeda is trying to accomplish here, or what these jihadist groups are trying to accomplish here.
Yeah, well, John, that was centuries ago. I think we have now turned the page, and I think we must stand up for our values. The problem we are facing in Europe at this moment is of a very important influx of additional immigrants, illegal immigrants, and the refugees coming out of North Africa and the Middle East. Many of them who have been suffering from the violence in Syria. And there are two problems. One is that governments are struggling to absorb this caseload of people coming into our countries. And secondly, there's the integration or reintegration problem, and the problem of youngsters who turn violent and extremist. I would also submit that this tragic, violent incident will have further repercussions as far as the extreme right is concerned. In France, as you know, the populist National Front is likely to gain further support as a result of the indignation about this violent act. And we will also perhaps see in the short term some acts of backlash or retaliation against Islamic mosques.
And that's certainly not something that would be confined to France. People are on alert all over Europe for precisely those phenomena that you describe. Peter Feit, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Peter Feit is a Dutch diplomat and former special representative for the European Union. He spoke to us from Sweden. What are the limits when it comes to the way we talk about religion?
Hi, this is David in Ohio. What happened in France is just atrocious. But at the same time, I wonder if the magazine had written their cartoons making fun of different ethnicities or different sexual orientations, would our attitude be different? Why do we feel that it's a right to blaspheme, make fun of someone's religious perspectives? I think that putting down someone's religion maybe is out of bounds.
This is Daniel from Beaverton, Oregon. There is an easy line that anyone can follow. Express yourself as you wish, but don't try to force others to participate. Make jokes in a bar or on stage for your audience, but don't grab a megaphone or plant yourself in the way of people who did not consent to being a part of your experience. You have the right to be yourself, think and feel however you wish, share what you want with those that consent, and to not be forced to participate in anyone else's beliefs, but you have to honor and protect the same rights for others.
Hi, this is Anne. I'm calling from Oberlin, Ohio. Whatever happened to the Golden Rule? Do people not know what that is anymore? Because if more people would follow that, there'd be a whole lot less problems on this planet. Look at yourself and see how you want to be treated. Then look at the other person and treat them that way.
Explore your rights and the rights of others in this discussion. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
Without freedom of speech, we are dead. We can't live in a country without freedom of speech. I prefer to die than live like a rat.
Back to the story unfolding in France. That's Stéphane Charbonnier, the editor of the journal Charlie Hebdo, speaking 2 years ago to ABC News. He's gone, killed in this week's attack in Paris, even though he always maintained that he would never be deterred from publishing his work. Today, his pages are blank, and so is a somber image from The New Yorker magazine, published in protest. A blank frame with the caption, "Please enjoy this culturally, ethnically, religiously, and politically correct cartoon responsibly. Thank you." The death of the artists and journalists at Charlie Hebdo strikes deep in the heart of longtime New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Mankoff, where an editorial fight over whether this or that cartoon goes into the magazine, any of these arguments are echoes of deeper conversation about pushing cultural limits, crossing lines, and the lurking monster of censorship. Bob Mankoff, welcome back to The Takeaway.
It's good to talk to you, John.
How are you feeling, and what motivated you to reprise that blank image with the caption there yesterday?
Well, you know, I think that was first published after the Danish cartoon controversy, and it just shows the situation we are in with freedom of speech blackmail. There's something people seem to forget that. You know, let me say right off, I'm not a huge fan of the cartoons of Charlie Hebdo. Some of them are okay. They're outrageous, provocative. They're all about the other. Where our cartoons are more self-reflective. But freedom of speech is for the speech we don't like or don't approve of. So, that's how I feel about Charlie Hebdo. That's why we have to defend it. It'd be easy to defend it if I said, hey, I'm a huge fan of their cartoons. I'm not a huge fan of their cartoons. That's really why, why we have to defend it. On a personal level, it's a horror. It's you know, there are very few good reasons to kill someone. And there are a million bad ones. But on the top of the list, the bad ones have to be you're offended by their joke.
Although, and I'm not an apologist for Charlie Hebdo, and I'm interested in some of the authors that are reflected in there. Hulebeck, the author who was focused on in this, who takes Salman Rushdie and goes way beyond it in his latest book, which really is at the seat of this entire controversy over in France. But given that, we've had in our discussions this week already the idea that tactically the jihadists here were able to use an offensive magazine to some to peel away that constituency from the notion of tolerance in France. So moderate Muslims are disinclined to condemn this attack because they are offended by this magazine. Did Charlie Hebdo have that coming on some level?
Well, I don't think I don't think it has it coming. Because I don't give humor a pass. Humor can be criticized just like anything else, but I also don't give religion a pass. I mean, the whole religious thing becomes bizarre to me because we can argue and criticize and ridicule without limit anything for which we actually have evidence and facts for, like Obamacare. But the one thing in which we have really no evidence and facts for, religion, that there we can't ridicule. So I think that way, I think Charlie Hebdo is very, very useful. Look, at the New Yorker, our humor is pretty benign. When we tweak religion, it'll be God saying, I hate to admit it, but everything happens for no reason at all. Or a guy coming out of church saying to the priest, I know he works in mysterious ways, but if I work that mysteriously, I get fired. So I don't think it has it coming in any way at all. The only way it can have it coming is to respond either in kind with satire or with arguments. So that's what it should have coming.
Bob, do you think there's a tradition in France of the cartoonists, and maybe in Europe generally, that the cartoonists have a little more clout? They're deeper in the conversation. They're less of a decoration in the magazine and more of a central thing.
I think we need something. Look, the place isn't the New Yorker, but we need something like Charlie Hebdo in the United States. I think in the United States, for editorial cartoonists themselves are losing their jobs. Humor itself, humor in politics really doesn't exist because it's just... It's just speech writers who are writing it. There's no genuine humor in argument, the way that Lincoln would use it. You never have, in other words, humor is not really being used as it should be in argument and even to provoke. So I think you're absolutely right. I think in France, because of this tradition, really untrammeled, untrammeled free speech. You know, you really have to relate Charlie Hebdo to the Sony interview thing. Also, everyone was really ready to throw free speech under the bus pretty quickly there until they got blowback on that.
And yet the interview story is a ridiculing of a country that essentially functions as a concentration camp. So
right.
There's something that's sort of open season about North Korea that isn't the case for Muhammad and certainly isn't the case for, say, the Holocaust and other limits that we underscore and recognize here in the West.
But I don't think there should be limits on that. I do think that the offense of offense is overrated, really, and the truth is most of it is used as a pretext. After all, ISIS didn't need any pretext of jokes to kill people, or real extremists don't. And it is sort of bizarre to say, one of the things I think that Charlie Hebdo makes us look at is, let's see, you're saying I can't draw Muhammad. I understand why you can't draw him. That's your religion. But how is it that I can't draw him? No, that would be very, very strange. If you're a really Orthodox Jew, you're not allowed to say God. But no one is saying that other people can't say it, or if I'm a Reformed Jew or an atheist, I can't. It's really, it does challenge us, like, why is this permitted?
Bob Mankoff, cartoon editor at The New Yorker, reacting to the Charlie Hebdo attack this week in Paris. Thanks, Bob.
Thank you, John. Bye-bye.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Later this hour, we're going to hear some delightful stories of people bonding with pianos placed randomly in public spaces like, for say, airports. But first, some thoughts about people bonding with an all-weather, rugged floor carpet, turquoise and teal, geometric pattern that says PDX, Portland, Oregon, the Portland Airport. Yes, this is a story about a love affair with an airport carpet and the heartbreak from the decision by the Portland Airport to apparently rip up the old blue-green fabric. Alan Casinelli owns the PDX Carpet online store, which sells products boasting the PDX carpet pattern. Alan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
I would think you'd be really excited about this because that carpet's got to be worth more than the airport itself in little coasters and welcome mats all torn up, right? And you'd be in line to get all that.
Yeah, I hope to get a piece of the actual carpet once they actually rip it up, but we'll see how that goes.
Now, it's hard for me to see the trajectory from carpet in an airport to people really think it's cool to an actual online store that sells carpet stuff. Can you sketch out that story for me?
Sure. Well, the carpet was, installed in 1987 and has really been there for my entire life. So it really brings back a sense of nostalgia for people who go to the Portland Airport. And, at this point, it's almost kind of like a Portlandia kind of inside joke for people who are born and raised in Portland and just seen that kind of iconic, 80s kind of Atari style look brings back those memories of home for people who travel to and from Portland. And that's kind of why I started the store. Is there's all these people who live outside of Portland who want to, hold on to that sense of that home feeling that the PDX carpet always brought them. So we sell T-shirts and pillows and tote bags to kind of give them and allow that kind of memory of the carpet to live on.
We're in the T-shirt and tote bag business here at WNYC Radio, so we're kind of bros here on this. what is iconic about that carpet? Is it because it's so ugly? Is it because of the color scheme, the geometric shapes? What?
I think the color scheme is something that it's kind of a blast from the past, especially the kind of the logo design as well, as you don't really see kind of logos like that anymore. And it just has so much history. I think with each person has lots of different moments kind of associated with the PDX carpet, when you're flying home for Christmas or meeting in-laws and whatnot, you see the PDX carpet before you even see the people nowadays. So it's kind of that first really visual moment that you know that you are home.
Well, I'll tell you, I can't remember the look of a carpet in any airport I've ever been to, including Portland. But, hey, that's just me. And you can go to thetakeaway.org and get some, you know, Portlandia endorphins induced in your own brain. We've got the pattern over there. Why wouldn't they just put a new carpet down that's exactly the same as the old one before we go?
You know what? I think that's what a lot of people wish that they had done, is just keep the same carpet logo, but they are replacing it with this new one that, you know, just, it looks like, kind of like what you said, it looks like a generic carpet airport and doesn't really have that feeling of Portland that this old one has had since 1987.
Which might just boost the value of all that stuff in the PDX carpet online store, huh, Alan?
Yeah, I'm hoping so.
Good luck. Alan Casinelli, owner of the PDX Carpet online store, the carpet being replaced at the Portland airport.
Thanks, Joe.
Time, I think, for some show tunes.
Try to remember the kind of September when life was slow and oh so mellow.
The Fantastics. Pop tunes.
I feel the earth move under my feet.
Thank you, Carol. Bang tunes. Hit it, Elton. Or the confessional piano tunes of Tori Amos.
Never was a cornflake girl. Thought that was a good solution. Hanging with the rays.
The regrets of Ben Folds. Event-filled love life.
I want to ask you, do you ever sit and wonder it?
The person who can sit down at the piano and rock the room has a special superpower. As we note the disappearing piano in America this week, we have been speaking to people who are evidence of its solid presence in our communities and families, despite a decline from the golden age of pianos a century ago. Luke Jerram, you might say, uses pianos as bait to attract the people with the piano player superpower. You're listening to it right now. This is from his art installation called Play Me, I'm Yours. It includes over 1,300 pianos, 45 cities, started in 2008, continues to this day. In 2015, the pianos head to Florence. Luke Jerram, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. How have you observed people sitting down and doing amazing things on the piano? I'm sure you've heard a lot of, you know, chopsticks and, you know, la, 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 la.
To be honest, you never quite know when someone sits down if they're going to be really rubbish or if they're going to be this amazing talent, sort of undiscovered talent. And we've had some, just witnessed some extraordinary things from sort of homeless men playing on streets in Canada, you know, writing and making their own music. We've had child prodigies turning up playing the most amazing Bach. Anything seems to be possible. And it's been a privilege to sort of witness the public's interaction with the art project.
What did you anticipate you would be pulling on when people see a piano? What echoes of a time past do pianos evoke?
Yeah, well, I suppose you know, I'm phoning up from Bristol in England at the moment. And certainly in the UK, the piano used to be the main source of entertainment for people. So in the front room of someone's house, they might have a piano. And this was before the radio came along and certainly before the television. So you'd all have a sort of sing-song. And all that is gone now. So piano companies are just throwing out hundreds and hundreds of pianos each year. And there's something quite sad about it. So what I'm doing, I suppose I'm giving a lot of these old pianos a new lease of life and putting them on the street for a number of weeks for the public to play. I suppose the reason why the art project is really quite successful is it provides a blank canvas for the public to express their creativity.
And I can remember in my grandmother's house, the piano was the center of the living room and was also this immaculate piece of art furniture that was not to be touched and not to be banged on, and don't scratch the piano. Are you surprised that there seems to be relatively little, if any, vandalism or bad treatment associated with the pianos that you just leave out on the street?
I think it depends where you put the piano. So in my home city in Bristol, we put the pianos in some quite rough parts of the city, and we had pianos that were damaged. But generally around the world, you know, I've installed 1,300 pianos now. Generally, we find that people are very respectful. Each of the pianos that we install, they've got the words "Play me, I'm yours" on. So that's a sort of invitation, an instruction for people to engage with them.
Do you like to stand behind the nearby wall and watch sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, it's nice. It's a nice thing to sort of sit down and see what happens. And sometimes there's a whole queue of people, you know, waiting to have a go. We've had almost like 10 million people now have played these pianos in different cities around the world. We put a piano in a train station in Sao Paulo. A piano over there costs like a year's wage. And we came across a mother and a daughter. And it turns out that the mother had worked as a cleaner for about 4 years to send her daughter to piano lessons on the other side of the city. But, you know, as pianos are so expensive, they could never actually afford their own piano. And after 4 years of working as a cleaner, she'd never heard her daughter play. And they came across this piano in the train station, and the daughter sat down and played beautiful music for her mother for the first time. And her mother burst out into tears. And, you know, it was a wonderful, wonderful thing.
And you were right there?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, man, that's too much. That's like that's like a musical right there. Can you tell the story before we go of someone who just, you had no conceivable hope that they would be able to play, who sat down, either a tiny child or, you know, someone in a trench coat or some old person who could barely even walk and absolutely blew you away?
Yeah, no, that's happened quite a lot. In fact, there's a film that's gone completely viral at the moment of a piano in Edmonton in Canada. It's been seen 3.5 million times of this homeless man playing a piano that's his own composition, and it's absolutely beautiful. And the same thing happened with a homeless guy in Peru in Chile, and he's covered his head with an old sort of blanket, and he's hiding away. And you can see he literally hasn't played piano for 20 years. And it's like he opens up like a flower until he plays this most beautiful music. And again, that film's been seen by about 5 million people. You know, I've seen a homeless man playing with, businessmen laughing and clapping along. And it sort of opens up. It makes people come together. In fact, in London, we put a piano in Liverpool Street Station. And a guy walked past, a girl playing the piano, and he said, "Oh, that was good. Could you just show me that bit that you just did there?" They sat down together and gave each other almost piano lessons, and decided to meet the following day. They fell in love and actually had the piano at their wedding about 6 months later.
Oh, remarkable. Do you play?
I play quite badly. But, I suppose I'm one of those musicians. I play a little bit at home, but there's no way you'd catch me playing in front of friends or family. But somehow I'm quite willing to go and play a street piano.
Luke Jerram's art installation is called Play Me, I'm Yours. He's a visiting research fellow at the Center for Fine Print Research at the University of West of England, where he joined us. Luke, thanks so much.
An absolute privilege. Thanks very much.
2, 3, 4. Might seem crazy what I'm about to say. Sunshine, she's here, you can take a break.
Some music from the Play Me, I'm Yours, Luke Jerram project. A lot of you are joining this conversation.
My name is Alex. I am from Bend, Oregon, and I will gladly tune up to the Flintstones. I learned it years ago playing with my father, and I've forgotten everything since, but still love that Flintstone theme song.
Patricia Garef calling from Chatsport, Pennsylvania. I can still play pretty much by heart, Sarah Lee by Beethoven.
Da 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 da. And the Flintstones, of course. Ba-bum, ba-ba-ba-bum. Anybody else?
This is Anne from Round Rock, Texas. I took piano lessons for 10 years as a child, and my piano teacher passed away. My first piano teacher passed away when I was in junior high. There are a couple of pieces that are very close to my heart, one of which is Prelude No. 1 from Well-Tempered Clavichord by Bach, and also Prelude in A Major by Chopin. These two pieces remind me of playing with my teacher, whom I loved very much.
Take us out, Anne, from Round Rock, Texas. Join our conversation. Tell us the piece you still play joyfully at thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.